welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode of Shypedia. This is your girl, Marsha Marsha. And last week, I introduced most of you to Foster Care Awareness Month. Last week, we had a gentleman on. He was a filmmaker, and he was sharing his experience about being in a foster care system. But this week, we have a sister on the line, Miss Jenny McKnight. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
She's a Chicago native, and she's an artist. She's a filmmaker. She has a pretty long rap sheet. It's actually building as we speak, but she was also in the foster care system. And today, we're going to get to know Miss Jenny McKnight. Jenny, please, we're going to start out with the younger Jenny McKnight. Let's go back to what brought you to who you are today.
I think this is really what got my film to stand out. So the first line in the film synopsis is snatched from her mother's care on the morning of her seventh birthday.
Okay. Now what is the name of your film that you have now? It's a short documentary, and what's the name of it?
It's called Moving Home.
Moving Home. Okay.
Yes.
Now why did you choose that title, Moving Home?
Well, it's pretty much the essence of the experience of growing up in foster care. It's a very transient experience, especially if you start at such a young age and you don't get adopted. Mm-hmm. So there's like this constant notion of, well, not notion, it's a constant reality of movement. And then the home part, is kind of like defining, what is home and the quest for home, where can home be found? And then essentially, I did end up buying a home in Baltimore. So wow. It's kind of like a full circle, just examination of my life, really.
Okay. Now, but before becoming a filmmaker, you were an artist as well.
Yeah, so my art career, it actually began in our tender moments when we attended William School.
Okay, so this is for the listening audience out there right now. Okay, let's give a little backstory. Myself and Miss Jenny McKnight, we attended elementary school together. We were classmates. I don't recall which grade it was. But, I recall being that little girl, and I wanted her to be my friend. I wanted to be friends with her, and which we did become friends, but it seemed to be short-lived. And being young, I didn't understand why, because eventually Jenny moved. She transferred. I didn't know where she went, and so I thought that was the end of that. And then we did end up crossing paths later on, maybe a year or two later, in Chicago. And that was the last time. But then we come to now being adults, and in the world of Facebook, we cross paths again. And Lord and behold, she has this story. I have been intending on getting her into the podcast a while back, but I wanted to get her on when it made sense. And I said, this is now the time to get her on. This is a perfect time. And it makes sense.
Yes. Total,
right.
It makes total sense.
Uh-huh.
Timing is excellent. A week from now, I was like pulling my hair out like, oh, how am I going to do all this travel and, crowdfunding for the trip to France. And it was a lot going on. So this is actually amazing timing. But yeah, you're right. Like, we started out, I started drawing at Williams.
Okay.
Some of those art competitions in class.
Now, do you think that you found yourself being more so an artist back then because was it some type of escape for you? Or this is just, of course, it was a talent, but do you feel like you went to that because it was an escape?
Well, this is going to be hardcore. All
okay.
right. So,
mm-hmm.
We were in the same third grade class together. I think we were in Miss Davis's class together.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Most of the people who drew were like the boys in the class.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was more so of asserting myself in that space. I'm like, well, I can draw too, and I could probably draw better. And so one day, I had drawn a picture of one of our fellow classmates that will remain nameless that I had a crush on. And we ended up going to my junior's turnabout.
Oh. So
that's a whole other story.
Wow.
Anyway, right?
Okay.
I know, but still, it's a brother. I looked at him as a brother. But anyway, I got in trouble for that drawing because somebody put Mrs. Davis's name underneath, you know, his face, and it was clearly a drawing of a boy.
Yeah.
And so she was like, "Who did this?" You know, and then for a long period of time, I don't know if, you know, people even noticed, but like on certain days, she would make it seem like I was going to the principal's office.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really going to, I believe her name was Mrs. Hatcher.
Uh-huh.
I was going to her music classes, and I would just be sitting in there drawing. As like a timeout, if you will.
Wow. Okay.
And so, right. But it was like, I felt bad because, you know, like Miss Davis was like, when she saw his picture with her name on it, she was like, "Girls don't draw." And that stuck with me. You know, it wow. stuck with me so much so that like most of my friends in high school and even undergrad didn't even know that I had the ability to draw.
Mm.
But if you go back to some of the people that we actually went to elementary school, like who are actually on Facebook, not only do they remember that I can draw, they remember that day that I had gotten in trouble.
Mm.
So, so
I don't know where yeah. I was, probably in La La Land somewhere in class.
I'm probably being good. You were so good, Martha. Oh my God. So you were so good. It was like, it's like, of course you, I wanted to be your friend. It's like, you know, I was like the trouble maven one. So.
Yeah, but who knew them? I didn't know.
I used to get in trouble all the time. Like, they would always get sent to Mr. Smith's office. They didn't know what to, they did not know what to do with me. And you know, and then also I found out that, you know, I just had a lot of energy, and I learned at a really quick pace.
Mm-hmm.
What a lot of people didn't know was that, you know, I had straight A's at that time, and I had tested very high on the I-STEP test.
Mm-hmm.
To where the state of Indiana proposed to skip me two grades. But because I was a ward of the state, the judge at the time said that I couldn't do it because I would have aged out of the system by the age of 16.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would have still been considered a minor.
So at that time, in the third grade, you were a ward of the system at that time?
Yes. Hmm. I was starting on my seventh birthday, which, yeah, I was going to Beveridge at that time, though. So, yeah, I was at Beveridge. And the morning of my seventh birthday, I went to school, you know, thinking everything was normal. I had gotten the Mrs. Santa Claus role in the school play. And I was, you know, I was ready. It was my birthday, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a December baby. So, you know, 2 weeks before Christmas. And I got a call from the guidance counselor, and I thought it was like a special birthday surprise, and it was the case manager who had pretty much been kind of interviewing my sister and myself for the past like 2 weeks or so, and she pretty much took us on the spot. You know, my mother was in the hallway crying, and that was actually the last day that I physically lived with my mom.
Mm.
And so after that day in Beveridge, then the next day is when I started going to Williams.
Oh.
Right. So I had to readjust very quickly. And luckily, I'm resilient. I have a very resilient spirit. Mm-hmm. So I was able to, you know, make some really lasting friendships, I guess. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we're having this conversation now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so that was ultimately my entry into the foster care system. It was on the morning of my seventh birthday.
Man, you thought it was a special
yeah.
birthday, but that was not the case.
Not at all.
And prior to that, you guys were on the radar. What was it that, I hate to go so deep, but if you're not open to sharing, that's fine. But what was it with your mom that they decided that you guys were best to be outside of her care?
Well, ultimately, you got to go back to like the 80s. Reagan was in office, and there was this huge push for welfare reform. So anybody who was receiving like food stamps or, you know, SNAP assistance, their families were ultimately targeted. And my mother was actually married to my father. And so, you know, any homes that had the father figure living in the house and they were receiving welfare benefits, those homes were flagged. But on top of that, you know, my father was a Vietnam vet. So there was definitely some domestic abuse involved. So that was also a red flag. Poverty was a red flag. And, you know, just, you know, but I would really put like poverty and, severe like post-traumatic stress disorder that my mother was experiencing from handling all that with us always moving around. So, that definitely put a spotlight on the family, for sure. I know.
Yeah.
I know.
It's definitely different back then compared to now. Because now you would think that, you know, they try to at least give you more support and try to guide you into the right direction versus trying to break up the families.
Right. Yeah, it was definitely an Operation Dismantle. The caseworker, she was a white lady, and it was like, I really didn't even talk to her at all. She thought, you know, something was wrong with me, but it was just like, you could tell she was like searching for just anything. And, you know, it's heartbreaking, you know, when I look back at the situation, because, you know, a lot of things have been revealed to me about, initially I thought, you know, my family was just like the poster child of dysfunction. And, you know, it actually wasn't as dysfunctional as presented.
Yeah, that's what it seemed. That's what it sounded like to me.
But, you know, for me, you know, it's like, you know, I always, you know, bad is bad. I try to give, the benefit of the doubt with things, you know, if they're professionals, you know.
And they're supposed to know.
They're supposed to know. But as information has revealed itself, that's not the case at all. So they really dismantled the family with a lot of false information. Instead of attempting to rehabilitate and assist, you know, they were quick to diagnose my mom with schizophrenia, you know, because she, back then, like when I was living with her, we were skirt girls, so we weren't allowed to, you know, wear pants or anything like that. That's why my ears to this day aren't pierced, because, you know, we were under the very strict guidelines of the Pentecostal faith. And
I just remembered that you did wear blue jean skirts a lot, right?
Now you know why.
Okay.
Now you know why. So and it's like, maybe that's why I rarely wear them now. But no, I'm just playing. No, that's for real. I rock a business suit.
Okay, so after third grade, you were taken away completely. Relocated.
I was relocated to Chicago. So I ended up moving with my mom's sister, and she.
So you were still in a family, so that's good, right?
No, it was actually
okay.
Hell, that was hell. So when I was at Williams, the foster home that I ended up staying in, that had to be the second foster home that I stayed in when I was still, you know, when I was still at Williams. You know, that was probably the most stable home because I was there from the second grade up until the fifth grade. And so when my aunt came into the picture, you know, I was under the impression that, you know, because I was moving to Illinois from Indiana, that, you know, maybe there was some type of adoption going on or whatever. But, you know, my last name had never changed. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, my mom would always say, you know, she would never want me to live with that particular aunt. That would be the worst thing in the world to happen. And that ended up being the truth. That was a very terrible experience on so many fronts. And usually that's what people, you know, think. They think that, oh, you're with family, blah, blah, blah. But all that time I was there, I had no idea that they pretty much taking me in as a foster child. So they were still getting paid by the state of Indiana.
They were doing it for the money.
Right. And they were, but it was like, it was across the border exchange, because I was living in Chicago. You know, they lived in Chicago, but they were receiving money from the state of Indiana. I don't even know how they were even able to execute that.
Yeah.
But, so that's a good, you know, I don't even have the bandwidth to research that. But so all while I was there, because I was with family, no case managers were coming out to see me to make sure I was okay. And, you know, granted, you
when
know,
the system fails.
The system failed. I mean, I was living in the south suburbs, you know, Hazelcrest on the borderline of Homewood, Flossmoor. So, you know, it's still a nice area, but, you know, the things that I experienced behind those closed doors, you know, it was like Color Purple turns into a horror film, you know.
Was it with you and your sister together?
No. That's the other thing. I was the only one that moved to Chicago. My sister, and I have an older brother, too. They stayed in Indiana.
So you guys were split up throughout up until what age?
Until forever. I haven't lived with my sister since the morning of my 7th birthday.
Wow. Now, are you close with your sister now?
You know, we have our moments. I'm the youngest. So, you know, sometimes I'm considered the prodigal one. It's very tough because, you know, I went away, and so there was so much mystery around my absence, because no one really knew what was going on. You know, here it is, this, like, 10-year-old girl, you know. People are speculating that she just, like, skipped off into the sunset. And it wasn't until my freshman year. I actually started my freshman year in high school at Hillcrest, which is in it's Country Club Hill, Illinois. There was a new case manager assigned to my case my freshman year in high school. So she made the trip out to Country Club Hill to interview me at school. And she just, something within her spirit just didn't feel right. And so she met with my aunt. And ultimately, my aunt told her that they should be kissing her feet, that she is taking care of me, and that was a red flag.
Now, did you ever speak out?
No, I didn't. It was, I was afraid, you know.
You know, that's the story that I usually hear when a child is in that situation. Sometimes they just don't say anything. Is it the fear of people not believing you, or?
Yeah, it was that. Well, because the with the Me Too campaign, you know, that resonated with me, because, you know, I experienced that living, you know, at my aunt's home, and they were prominent pastors in a very prominent church in Chicago. You know, not only was it the pressure of that experience, but it was also the pressure of, you know, these people are a part of a very well-established ministry, and it's just like, where do you begin, you know?
Now that makes sense. I can only imagine as a child, and knowing the status that these people have, especially in a community and being in a church, how can you fight against something like that? You know,
exactly.
they put on a good mask.
Yeah, they put on a good mask, and they donate a lot to the building fund. And so, you know, how can you compete with that?
Ultimately, how did you end up getting out of that? Or did you?
Well, you know, like I said, I had gotten a new case manager assigned to the case, and she's a black woman, mm-hmm. and she traveled from Gary to Chicago to interview me at school. And during that interview, my silence really didn't sit too well with her. But then, like I said before, my aunt actually told her that, you know, the state of Indiana should be kissing her feet. That, and so, you know, that was enough for her to, report back to the judge of what she encountered. And 2 weeks later, they put a court order in to take me from their custody. It was like an adult kidnapping. The case manager, she came to my school. I was in my final period. And my guidance counselor came, and she was like, Jenny, I just want to let you know that you're going to be going back to Indiana. And I'm like, what? And, this is a guy. So the guidance counselor, she was so important to me because she was our junior high school guidance counselor. Mm-hmm. And she ended up getting a promotion to the high school level just so that she can make sure that, you know, we stayed on track. Because at that time I was an honor student and just doing really, really well academically. And, her support, was like big. And so when she came to pull me from my last period class and told me I was going back to Indiana, I was devastated. And I ended up leaving straight from there back to Gary. And I didn't have any clothes. You know, all of my belongings were still at my aunt. And, she refused to give them up until she received the last check.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm glad. It was like a rescue, you know? And there's too many cases where you have people who's just blind, you know? And exactly. They don't do anything about it. And these kids just, they don't have the same outcome, you know? And they have to suffer. And it's just devastating. Do you feel...
It passed away. The Devontae Hart, like that, you know, that story with the young boy who... you know, had the sign with, I'm giving out free hugs, and how it went viral during the protest. And then later to find out, you know, he was being neglected by his adoptive, adoptive people, and they ended up, you know, driving him off the cliff. You know, like, it's like that's really where, you know, like it hit home about, you know, Jenny, you can do, you have life, you have breath. It's a painful experience to recount. However, there are important stories that need to be shared, and you know their voices aren't accessible.
Yeah.
So you have to be that voice, and so it was a rescue.
Okay. And, do you think it would have made a difference if it was an African American caseworker?
Well, yeah, because again. They weren't on a mission to dismantle. So, you know, you have to look. And then even right now, most caseworkers are African-American, at least in predominantly black cities.
Okay.
Because it's no longer like a witch hunt. There's really no need. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that it's just the way poverty is systematic now. So. Okay. It's like, it's best to just keep the children in their respective homes. I wouldn't say that there needs to be more. I think that there needs to be a reckoning for how policy, when it's driven by people who don't have that ethnicity,
uh-huh.
It needs to be triple checked before it's implemented.
True, because they cannot necessarily relate, basically.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
To the policies that they're putting forth.
Yeah.
And so that's like what happened during the war on welfare, or allegedly the war on drugs. You know, it really dismantled. You know, homes that their biggest crime was trying to fight through. The symptoms of poverty in their area.
Mm.
Getting outside of the anger, getting outside of the hurt, getting outside of, you know, every birthday is an anniversary of that experience. Mm. So, I mean, even that within itself, it was just, it was lazy on the state of Indiana's part to, you know, do that. And so, but getting beside all of that, you know, really like digging deep to figure out, you know, how can, you know, we as humanity better serve, you know, children who are in need, is something I've been wrapping my mind around.
Okay.
More so the past year than anything else. It's just even just rekindling with my mom, it's like mind blowing how different our lives are. And
when did you reestablish a relationship with your mom?
So back in 2010, I received a phone call from my sister, and you know, she was like, guess who I just spoke with. And I'm thinking, you know, it was one of her exes or something like that. So, you know, I had to mentally prepare myself. I'm like, oh, who come back into the picture now? it ended up being, she's like, Mom. I'm like, what? Mm. And, you know, I was like totally floored in that moment. And so she had given me her contact information. And we spoke. And
now, mom reached out to her, or she found mom herself?
So our mother reached out to one of her siblings because, you know, she was actually in Arizona at the time. She was having a tough time there. Mm-hmm. And she reached out to one of her siblings, and then finally, our uncle, which is the one she reached out to, he told my sister, hey, I have contact information for your mom. This is her number. And then it was funneled over to me.
Mm. Now, was this were you looking forward to this time? Had you ever went on your own to try to find your mom? Were you ever interested?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I did for years. You know, the last place. So when I was living with her sister in Chicago, she had called just to see how I was doing, mm-hmm. but I really couldn't talk with her because they would listen to like all the contents of my phone conversation.
Yeah.
And so she was in the hospital. She was at a white memorial hospital in Los Angeles. And she didn't sound like she was doing too well. And so, you know, from that moment on, I never knew what happened. I mean, I knew she was in the emergency room, but I never knew what took place. And I knew she said she was trying to get a divorce from my dad. And so, you know, I was always searching by her maiden name, you know, like, or even if it was like a Jane Doe or whatever, you know, I was just trying to find, you know, anything.
Yeah.
And come to find out, she never changed her last name from,
okay.
you know,
her
that night.
Okay.
And that's alternate. So she kept that. And so I was searching for the wrong name. After a while, I thought she was deceased anyway. So so that was really the big shocker, you know, when I got that call. I know, like, what? She's alive? Mm. What? I was, 26? Yeah, I was 26 when I got that phone call.
However, through all of the trials, you made it to triumph, and which is commendable because you don't have so many success stories like that, you know, due to the devastation and just looking at it mentally or psychologically, how it could have affected you. And you took it and you turned a negative into a positive based off of your art. You had that gift. Well, you have that gift.
Yes.
And you were able to look over all the bad things and just say, you know, you're grateful for being here right now. What helped bring you to this point, though? What is it? Is there anything or anyone that helped you help bring you here?
I have a very, 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 very strong relationship with God.
Okay.
And not the, in the, you know, like the Bible thumping in church every Sunday. But it's like my faith is
spiritual.
My faith is on steroids because I've seen some miracles that, you know, how I even got out of, you know, my aunt's custody and back into Indiana. You know, it was nothing but angels, you know, carrying me out of that situation, because I never spoke of those horrors until after I was like 20, like when I was 22, when he passed away. And I felt like, you know, well, now that the coffin is closed, you know, by the way, you know, these are some of the things that transpired. And but, you know, God was really my my ultimate friend, and I know it sounds so cliche, but it's just like when you're, you know, think of it like in captivity.
Yeah.
Like if you're in prison or in solitude, you know, it's like
you feel helpless. You're helpless.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And what all you can do is really cling to hope.
Uh-huh.
And then, I mean, there were some other outlets. You know, when I moved to Indiana, I was finally able to, like, as soon as I got there, I started running because I always knew I was fast.
Yeah, I know. So, you used to think you were fast. I don't think you were able to outdo me back in the day, but...
That's hilarious. If you go to Maryville High School's athletic section, and you see a picture of myself and my teammates holding up the first ever regional title of that school's history, there are pictures. I was pretty low key, you know, a big deal. But yeah, I didn't have the cheerleaders. You know, I ran in the 98 Junior Olympics for USA Track and Field.
Oh, okay.
I didn't have the cheerleaders, right? So it was a lot. Or even like I'm the first black woman to represent the state of Indiana for debate. So that movie, The Great Debaters, they could have like made a version for me.
Oh, congrats on that. I didn't know. Okay.
Most people, I mean, my debate coach knew, you know, but but I didn't have like, you know, and that was also one of the hardest things is like, here I am out here doing all these things. And I go to these events, I'm getting all these awards, and the first question everybody would ask, well, where are your parents? Who are your parents? And, you know, it was like a sword in my chest, you know? It was so hard, but I don't know. I think that was really what saved me, you know, no matter what. I'm like, you know, if I'm going to do anything, I might as well just put my all into it.
Yeah.
It'll help me get my mind off of, you know, how crazy my... It was like a fantasy world, you know. It's like I'm doing all these amazing things. I'm, you know, accomplishing all these things. Nobody would ever imagine that, you know, this person is going through, you know, what she has to go through when the competitions are over.
Well, you have this story now, and you're putting it out there into the film. What would be your advice to someone who's experiencing, if not the same thing, but something close to what you experienced when you were a child?
And that, you know, that's so hard. I pray about this a lot because I think sometimes some of the hardest advice you can hear is, well, because I did it, you can too. And I think that that's so unfair.
Yeah.
You know, because everybody has their own, like, internal challenges that they have to overcome. What I would say is, you know, like, keep whatever chip you have on your shoulder, you know, it's okay for it to be there, but don't get bitter, get better at whatever it is. You know, if you're good at, you know, ping pong, you know, some people may not understand the relevance of ping pong. When you're doing it, don't get bitter about it. Get better. Make sure you're the best. If you like to sweep, you know, be amazing at just every endeavor. Be amazing and just keep being amazing, because one day when you chip at that tree, you know.
Yeah.
You chip at that oak tree, you mm-hmm. know, enough times, that bad boy is going to fall.
Mm.
And that's my advice to, you know, not just people or children who are growing up in the system, but just anybody.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, just keep pushing, even when it doesn't seem like there's no way out, just do it for the possibility that there may be.
We want to get more into your artwork, though, because I do know about the billboards that you had up, the Harriet Tubman, the infamous Harriet Tubman billboard that you had in Baltimore, correct?
Yes.
How did that happen? How did you get that acknowledgement? Like,
it's like. Wow. And you know, this goes back. So a lot of this, and I'm so glad you're doing this interview, because a lot of this still goes back to Jenny as a little girl. So back in the day, I could never not get caught. Anything I did, I always got caught. No matter how I tried to hide it, I always got caught. And so I was like, you know, since I always get caught doing things, why not just do good stuff, you know?
Mm.
And so, right.
Wow.
I had that epiphany.
That's
really
a good
young.
Epiphany.
getting to the Harriet Tubman piece. So I had originally painted that painting. One of my friends told me about an exhibit that was happening at the Reginald Lewis Museum. Which is a black-owned museum here in Baltimore after the famous Reginald Lewis. And they were doing, like, a Harriet Tubman exhibit. And but it was, like, within 10 days. So I'm like, I don't have a Harriet Tubman painting. So I painted that painting. It's an oil painting. It's, like, 5 feet by 2 inches. And, yeah, I painted that, you know, to memorialize her 100-year passing, which was in 2013. And so I'm painting this painting. I submit, you know, the proposal to the Reginald Lewis Museum. And for whatever reason, that exhibit didn't happen, or something changed with it. And so here I am stuck with this painting. So there's a... Well, not stuck with it. It's still Harriet Tubman, but it's just like, you know, when you create art, you want it to have a life somewhere else.
Yeah.
So I was like, ah. Anyway, so this group that helped with, I don't know if you remember President Obama's, that Hope poster. It was like red, white, and blue.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was like real popular. It was like
yeah.
all over the place. The art team that helped compose that, they had been reaching out to me ever since like October of 2012. And I'm like, why am I on their listserv? So finally they had launched this this campaign called the See America campaign, which is it's an homage to the national park across the country, specifically the National Monument. Earlier in 2013, President Obama had recently designated the Harriet Tubman National Monument here in Maryland on the Eastern Shore. And I started thinking, I'm like, huh, so I've never done graphic design before. I have this painting. So how about I marry this painting, which is an analog format, to something digital, which would be the See America poster or whatever. So I submitted, they accepted that, and that poster ended up being the signage for Harriet Tubman National Monument.
What?
And yes.
Okay.
And so then it was put into a book. It was like a See America postcard book. And so in some of the stores in the National Park Service, that book with the Harriet Tubman piece for See America is in there.
Oh, okay.
And yes.
Wow.
So to amplify that, there was this the billboard that you see with Harriet Tubman on it. It was built, I would say, around the same time, 2012, 2013. And at that time, it was the largest, like, art-only billboard in the country.
Look and at you, so, breaking records again.
Well, I just saw it, and I'm like, my art is going to be up there. You know, I just spoke, and that's really what, I guess if I had to give a pointer, say the most outrageous thing that you can ever imagine with something you created, like research the highest height that it can go, and just speak that thing. And so that's what I did. I said, my art is going to be up there. And I, of course, I researched, you know, what was it about, who, you know, who did, and then I submitted. And like 4 months later, they invited me to insert my art. And so I got a chance to choose which pieces I wanted to be on display. And so that's ultimately how the Harriet Tubman See America piece landed up there, to also amplify that important campaign.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so that's another major accomplishment. Now, let's talk about the filmmaker. The filmmaker, Jenny. You have, your work will be in the Cannes Film Festival. Tell us about that.
So, junior year in high school, heavily scouted by universities. I ended up going to DePaul briefly. Well, not briefly. I was at DePaul. I did not matriculate, but that's another story. Mm-hmm. But I did go and my junior year. And in that experience, when they were trying to get us, you know, to go and convince us to sign, I met this tall, tall glass of water. No, I'm just being
wine funny. Or water?
Water. Glass of water.
Oh, okay.
It's a guy. I'm referring to a guy. We ended up going to DePaul together.
Okay.
He actually won the Oscar for Moonlight. I went to this movie with Terrell.
Oh, okay.
And I know. And so all of this is interrelated because, like, so before the exhibit and the billboard display, that was my second experience having my work on billboards. Mm-hmm. My first billboard exhibit was actually in Times Square in New York for the Artex Times Square exhibit.
Oh.
And, now that was a big deal because, like, our work was in the middle of, like, 42nd Street on all of those, like, billboards. Questlove was one of the judges, and then he DJed our after party. And it was, like, a big deal. And so the hotel I stayed in, I ran into Terrell. He was the manager there. And I was like, wow, you know, I told him why I was there. And he was telling me that he had, you know, a few bodies of work that were playing off Broadway. And I said, you know, one day I'm going to check you out. And fast forwarding up until when he won the Oscar, I'm like, wow, if he can do it, I can do it.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
You know, like speaking those things that are just like way, you know, what you would consider way beyond your grasp. So I started researching, like, well, what do you, like, when I do finally do a film, because, again, at that time I was more interested in doing animation, and I'm still interested in doing animation because, you know, I'm a techie at heart.
Mm-hmm.
But so the short doc, you know, it came about because, again, like, you know, just the experience of what happened last year, it was so compelling. And I'm like, okay, I need to speak to this. I need to speak to my life. And then from here, I'll be able to go and kind of unpack some of the other projects. So researching all of this stuff about how does one win an Oscar, I started looking at the requirements and, like, how many festivals and which festivals. And while Cannes is not one of them, it came up in my list. And I saw that it had been established for 71 years. And I'm like, okay, so it's legit. So why not? You know, it's in France. Hey, let's give it a go. And I had heard of it before.
Yeah.
But again, I'm not like a Hollywood, you know, insider. I'm still not. I'm like, well, yeah, well, let's see what happens. And literally, I submitted, on the 8th of March, and March 10th is when I received the invite to upload the
film.
And then after that, then I started researching it. I'm like, whoa. So this is like, you know, in some regards, it's even bigger than the Oscars, because that's ultimately where most films get their budgeting from. So like 80% of films, you know, they get funded there first.
That's interesting to know.
Before they even get put into production.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, it's so much wrapped into it. It's like a very, I had no idea how big of a deal it was until, you know, I'm reaching out to people who I knew who were Hollywood insiders who had been there for quite some time. And, you know, they started sliding me their film scripts. I'm like, whoa.
They were sliding you their film scripts.
Yes, Marcia. Yes, girl. Me.
Wow.
So I had to take a step back. I'm like, you know, and pray. I'm like, okay, what in the world have I gotten myself into? You know, what is this thing? And, you know, I say that with great joy, mm-hmm. but it's also the great responsibility.
Yes.
It's like, you know, it's a big deal.
So can we check out this short documentary? Are we able to check this out?
Eventually, yes.
Okay.
It's still in consideration.
Okay.
So it's pretty much going through the festival run right now. And so I'm trying to be patient. But, you know, apart because I'm like the director, I'm the screenwriter, I'm the producer, so I own 100% of everything for the film. So, you know, I could, you know, sign a few of the licensing things that are on the table now and just make it available.
Okay.
However, it would disqualify it from some of the accolades that I'm reaching for.
Okay.
So, when it comes to, I say I'll have a solid decision by September of when I would write. That's Marcia.
You have some months,
Marcia.
Huh?
Yes.
Okay.
Only because it's in consideration.
Yeah.
And so when it's in consideration, the film has to be sterile. You know, you can't have any public viewings specifically for some of the accolades that, you know, I'm looking towards. And again, I had to take this crash course within like a week. I had to learn, like, you know, the ins and outs.
Well, at least you did your research and you did that. You know, a lot of people, they take that L because they don't go and learn this stuff. So.
Yeah, and it was tempting because,
yeah.
you know, the Emmys reached out, you know, for news and documentary, I love the fact of how, you know, the feedback that I received, the movie is still eligible for next year, but if I had made it available now, then, you know, it would have disqualified my lofty endeavors.
Oh, well, that's good. Just sit back and be patient. And we're going to sit on this end, and we're gonna wait patiently as well, you know, because I foresee.
But, you know, I did submit it to I have to reach back out to the second one. So I did submit it out to one of the major festivals in Chicago. So if they give me the green light to that particular festival, it'll definitely be having its run there.
Okay.
So I'll definitely keep you posted.
Yeah, please do. Keep us posted.
And a shorter version of it. It's more like a teaser. It's actually in competition in L.A., so I'll be finding out about that in about 2 weeks.
Mm. Okay.
And Warner Brothers Studio. So I'm excited about that. I'm really more excited about the fact that I actually finally get a chance to meet Ava DuVernay. She's over the jury for that competition.
Yeah, I read that.
So,
okay.
So I'm excited about that.
Congratulations, anyways. You know,
thank you.
Are definitely the epitome of a success story, you know, a strong black woman at that. You're not limiting yourself. So you're definitely a great role model.
Aww,
you know, and I'm glad that we're able to pretty much put your story out there so that people can know that just because something bad happens in life doesn't mean that it's over. It's not over. As long as you're still here on this earth and you're breathing, there's always a chance. Just take advantage of that time and just be patient. So I definitely appreciate you sitting with us and sharing, I mean, just from point A to now, you know, because you have quite the story. You have quite the story. And I want the full film. I want to see the full film, you know.
And
where's the book? Where's the book?
Oh, so it happened in reverse. So initially, you know, I've been working on moving home for the ages.
Like, what makes you want to come back to Chicago?
Well, of course, Chicago's always home.
Yeah,
Chicago's always home. Well, Baltimore is home too. You know, I learned so much here.
Mm-hmm.
Negotiating like my first car. Well, mm-hmm. really my second car, but the one that I actually kept.
Yeah.
And just growing, you know, in the corporate structure, and you know, learning how to create my own business, and you know, so I've learned so much here in Baltimore.
It's added to your character.
Yeah, it did. It mm-hmm. really did. Without the shadow of my past.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I definitely want you to let everyone know how to find you. What's your website? What's your social media?
Well, I keep things pretty streamlined. My website is jennymcknight.com. And my name is unique. It's Jenny with a G. So GINNIE. And then McKnight, McKnight.com. And that's also like where you'll find me, like on Instagram at Jenny McKnight. Can you find me? Yeah, you can find me on Twitter with that as well.
Okay.
With my name.
And then some of your work, your photos and stuff with your artwork, that's up as well. You can find that on your site. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Well, we'll be sure to keep following you. So, Jenny McKnight, I am so glad that we had you on the show. I thank you so much for sharing some stuff with us, some jewels, sharing everything. And I look forward to bringing you back so we could talk about some other stuff. We could get deep if you want to or whatever. Or when you come to Chicago, you could come over to the studio so it could be more of a, you know, a better feel for us. So I thank you.
Thank you, Marsha.
On the line, I have Miss Tanikia Carpenter, the CEO and founder of Black Owned Chicago. Welcome to Chipedia Podcast, Tanikia.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
What brings you to the show, I would definitely say, is something that everyone needs to experience here in Chicago. So many people in Chicago that don't even get out and explore and learn the history that surrounds them. So, Tanikia, she has this great idea. Well, she came up with this idea 3 years ago, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So she came up with this great idea, and I'm going to go ahead and let her explain to you what she has lined up.
So my company, Black Owned Chicago, we recently turned 3 years old, and this actually started last year. We wanted to start Black Owned Chicago trolley tours that would take guests from downtown Chicago and bring them to the south side of the city. And so we are officially launching the Black Owned Chicago tours next month for the month of June only. It'll be every Tuesday in June, two tours a day. And we bring guests from Michigan and Adams, on a trolley to the south side of the city, because we know that in the news and just, you know, abroad, people tend to have this negative perspective about the south side of the city. And we know, as residents and natives of Chicago, that the south side is full of history, culture, and amazing historical landmarks that we want to highlight. And so we are officially launching our tours on June 5th, every Tuesday in June, and we're excited about it.
Oh my gosh, I'm excited. That is such a great idea, you know, because people, they don't realize how much history is on the south side of Chicago. And I mean, in the future, will we be able to extend this past June? Are you looking forward to maybe going more months?
So, you know, we want to extend it. And so this is sort of kind of like a trial to see how people respond to it. And, okay. You know, so far, as far as like ticket sales, what we're seeing is that, like, people are responding well. And we have had a few people ask, you know, can we have July because our camp doesn't start until the end of June, or for whatever reason. And so if the demand is there, then we will have the supply.
Oh, wow.
But so far, you know, I'm just amazed because, you know, at first I was like, well, you know, I'm Black and I'm from the South Side, and is this a tour that I would take? And after we did the route, there were so many things that I didn't even know, you know, like, I consider myself a history buff. I was like, wow, this is amazing. So even if you're from Chicago, if you are Black and you're like, well, you know, I don't need to necessarily go on this tour. You do. It's so many historical facts and gems that have been brought to our light and brought to our attention. And so we're just amazed at what's happening. People are bringing their families. A few senior groups have contacted us. A few schools have contacted us. And so it's a movement, and it shows that the demand is there. People want to see and explore their own neighborhood. And outside of people who are from Chicago, you know, we've had a few of my Caucasian brothers and sisters have been buying tickets in bulk and just, like, wanting to just, like, you know, explore our culture. And so we're excited. And I forgot to mention, we will have a goodie bag for each guest. So once you leave the tour, you will have a goodie bag, and it'll have products from Black-owned companies here in Chicago, coupons. Rico Nance, he's the owner of Lighthouse, and Mickey's Grill, he has given coupons for people to come by the restaurant and get 10% off. Z-Berry, Zinzi, she's the founder. She's giving coupons. Popcorn, Micah's the owner of Popcorn, which is in Bronzeville on 47th. He's giving each guest a small bag of popcorn. So it's just going to be like an amazing celebration of the South Side and Black entrepreneurship in Chicago.
This is such a great way to support our own. It's right here in our own backyards. And how did you even find out the new things? Like, who did you reach out to in order to learn the history that you did not know? You know, how did you organize this?
So my good friend, Tara, she does a lot of things here in the city. She went on a trial with us last year. And, you know, last summer, I was pregnant, and we were just, like, trying to figure it out. And so she's a little older, not too much older, but she's a little older. And so, you know, she had that wisdom that we didn't have, and she was pointing out stuff like, oh, you got to include this, and this is where this happened. And I'm like, whoa, oh, my gosh.
So
like,
it's going to be all of that. I don't want to tell everyone about do you want everyone to know every stop that you're going to, or you want it to sort of be a surprise?
Some things are a surprise.
Okay.
We'll go by the Obama's Hyde Park home. We will go by Eden Place Nature Center, which is the only Black-owned farm and operated nature center in Chicago. We will stop by the DuSable. And some things are a surprise. You know, are a surprise, are a shock. Our tour guide, she's an actress here in Chicago. Her name is Deanna Reed Foster. She played in South Side with You. She played in Chicago Fire. She was recently in Last Flag with Lawrence Fishburne. So she's a well-known face that's going to be actually our tour guide. So that's fun as well. So we're just excited. We're excited about it. We're excited about who's going to come. Hopefully some special guests will be on your tour.
You just never know, huh?
It's going to be exciting. You never know.
Yeah. Well, I am so glad that you are organizing this, because we spend so much money outside of our community, and people will come downtown to pay for the trolleys and just take tours of any other place around Chicago, but we don't necessarily get out and explore our own and find out what happened. You know, what happened? And this is a great way to bring it back to our community to see what we once had. And this is a great way to grow. And Tanikia, I commend you, because this is just such an awesome idea. I'm looking forward to July and August and the months moving forward, because I definitely feel like this is something that people are going to be really interested in. So once again, let's give everyone a date.
The tour starts on Michigan and Adams. We will be out there. You'll see me out there. You'll see a Black-owned Chicago sign. We'll be out there letting people know, hey, the tour is going to leave in about a few minutes or so. It's every Tuesday in June. So the first one officially kicks off at on June 5th. Then the next one will be June 12th. June 19th, and then my birthday, June 26th, is the last tour date. There are two tours each day. One starts at noon, and then the next one starts at 3. And each tour is about 2 hours.
Okay.
You can go on blackownedchicago.com to pick up your ticket. We want to sell out. That's my goal. My goal is to sell out, because last year when they said, you know, we stopped doing the tours after the Obama administration, I was like, why? You know, like, it's so much to see on the South Side.
Yeah.
So I just want to prove to myself and to people who may not know, just out of pure ignorance, but the South Side is worthy of coming to see. It's so much history. Like I said, it's a gem. It's a jewel. And we have to cherish our own. So I'm excited about it. So go on Black Owned Chicago and get your ticket.
Thank you, Tanikia.
Thank you. Thank you so much.